Foy Short, A Life in Southern Africa, Chapter 4, Gwelo. Gwelo, later called Gweru, had a population of 38,000 in 1961, and now is the third largest city in Zimbabwe. Its population in 2002 was 137,000. Shona and Isindebele are both spoken there. The Shorts decided to move to Gwelo because the Poot family, baptized in Bulawayo, had already moved there, along with Olwen Bowen Craig. These brethren helped start the English work. Foy already had some contacts among those of African descent in the area through a paper his father published. The Shorts carried much of their furniture and other goods to the train station in Gwelo on borrowed pickup trucks, where it was shipped up the line to Gwelo. They bought a house with 5 acres of land on Selukwe Road, that's now called Shurugwe Road, 3 miles southeast of the center of Gwelo in late 1957, and rented it out a few months before they actually moved in. Beginning the work. The Shorts held the first service of the new congregation in the Poot's home. Then they conducted most services in their own house until the congregation was able to rent the Hellenic Hall of a local Greek association. After renting the Hellenic Hall, the brethren bought a house and removed a partition in it to form an adequate meeting place for a number of years. Finally, the brethren built their own building and moved into it on March 28, 1971. The new congregation invited John Maples to come up from Durban, South Africa, to hold a meeting. The Bankstons came over from Bulawayo with a station wagon full of teenagers to help with the effort. Margaret said, "That week I had at least 20 for every meal." The meeting was a success, with one family being baptized into Christ. They, in turn, invited their next-door neighbor, Jean Jehu, who also became a Christian. Margaret began holding women's Bible studies in various homes. At one point, she conducted 2 sessions each week. She invited a Catholic woman, Dorothy Dams, who was teaching her music. Dorothy Dams hit it off with Jean Jehu and was eventually converted. Foy reported in the New Bulletin, "Our hearts were made to rejoice on the 9th of May when Mrs. Dorothy Dams was baptized into Christ." Dorothy Dams became very close to the Short family. Margaret said that she was like a member of our family. She was like a second mother to me, and I was like a daughter she never had. She taught violin and piano lessons to different members of the Short family during the years they spent in Gwelo. Foy wrote a tribute to Dorothy Dams, who died in 1978, in his April 2001 report. He said that from the time of her conversion on, her life was a living demonstration of what it means to love the Lord and to love His body, the church. As a music teacher, she had a musician's approach to the Bible. She would say, "Play it like it's written. The composer had a reason for writing the music the way he did." So, the Lord's work began to grow in Gwelo just as it had in Bulawayo, though it never became as large. Patty Kendallball says that Foy and others did a lot of door knocking during the first years in Gwelo. When Foy found contacts willing to study, he used a series of 8 charts that he designed for teaching the lost. The first lesson showed why belief in the Bible is rational. Later lessons demonstrated how the Bible reveals the gospel and the appropriate response to it. The final lesson was about serving Christ after becoming a Christian. Foy had many exchanges with Jehovah's Witnesses, both in Bulawayo and Gwelo, but especially in Gwelo. He studied their materials extensively and elaborated 2 study guides about their doctrine. First, witness versus the Bible. And second, witness versus witness. The latter dealt with contradictions among the witnesses. After the leading witness in Guelo began studying with Foy, the Home Office in Salisbury ordered him to stop because he had difficulty answering Foy's reasoning. Through his preaching years, Foy developed a number of other study notes on religious errors and difficult texts. Margaret recalls in particular a study of Matthew chapter 24. In his later life, he prepared extensive notes on Revelation, taking the position that many of the prophecies in the book had their primary fulfillment in the destruction of Jerusalem. He preferred to use his own material in Bible classes, handing out notes that the members kept in loose-leaf notebooks. In 2001, Margaret received a letter from Adele Margarison in which she said that her husband, Mike, used Foy's old class notes as a basis for the sermons he preaches in congregations in England. Adele's family had a long relationship with the Shorts. John Sheriff and his wife had cared for her mother, Ella, and Aunt Rhoda before sending them to Sunday Mission with Will and Delia Short to help with their children. Eventually, Adele and her husband, Mike, became very close to the Shorts through association both in Guelo and later in Bulawayo. Mike and Adele's third son, Angus, was an accomplished musician. Margaret called him her adopted son. Angus moved to England, where he taught school before dying prematurely of lung cancer. Adele and Mike Margarison were among some of the many long-term friendships that the Shorts established while living in Guelo. Many of the contacts for the work in Guelo came through the Shorts' children and their friends at school. Therefore, just as in Bulawayo, the congregation began to fill up with teenagers. Ellen Bay said, "Mom and Dad had Bible studies almost every night of the week. On Fridays, we still had games for the young people, as we'd done in Bulawayo." Doyle Gilliam, who was working in Malawi, visited the Shorts' home for a meeting in Guelo. After observing the coming and going of the different brethren, he said that he had never seen a place so much like Grand Central Station. Trip to Barotselan in 1958. Foy's father, W.N. Will Short, made contacts in an isolated British protectorate called Barotselan, a semi-desert wilderness area which is the home of the Lhosi people. The territory is now a part of western Zambia. Shortly after Foy moved to Guelo, he and his father decided to visit the area, seeking the contacts in remote villages. The trip was reminiscent of Will's long treks into remote parts of Zambia in the 1920s and his son Foy's later trips into the Zambezi River escarpment. However, motorized vehicles available in the late 1950s made it possible to take the family members into this remote region. The only roads in the area were sand tracks. Margaret wrote, quote, "Only four-wheel drive vehicles were allowed. They gave permission for us to take Daddy Short's small pickup since we had a Jeep, American military surplus, which we'd taken back to Rhodesia in 1956. The pickup did get stuck in the sand several times and had to be pulled out with a Jeep. Once it got stuck in the middle of a wide, dry riverbed of sand. When the Jeep went back to pull it out, the Jeep also got stuck, and they both had to be pulled out with a block and tackle," close quote. The trip, taken during the three-week Rhodesian school vacation in August and September of 1958, required extensive planning for food, diapers, bedding, gasoline, and other supplies. Margaret said, "Most of our nights were spent camping in the open. Foy's parents took small stretchers, and the rest of us spread our blankets on the ground." She added, quote, we traveled along the northern route and crossed the Zambezi River, where Foy remembers it was just a series of small channels that we could drive over. We then traveled south along the west bank of the river. By the time we reached the southern crossing at Sesheke, it had been fed by tributaries and was very wide. One of my most vivid memories is of crossing this vast expanse of water on a very crude sort of ferry with a number of men rowing it. The adventure made an impact on young Jim, who was 7 years old, and Ellen, who was 9. Jim remembered the lions roaring in the evening around the family's camp. Margaret and Ellen both remembered an incident one night while camping on the banks of the Zambezi River. Margaret wrote, "Daddy Short and Foy had chosen a campsite well back from the river's edge because of the danger of crocodiles. However, Ellen remembered that her brother Harold, who was 13 years old, and Uncle Bill, who was 15, wanted to show their teenage independence by camping a distance away from the others, by a large tree. However, to the boy's chagrin, Foy and his father wouldn't let them do it. According to their experienced eyes, the proposed campsite seemed too close to an access route to the river." Margaret said, "I woke up in the middle of the night to see Foy and Daddy Short beside a large fire that they had started. Daddy had woken to the roar of lions, and we stayed up until we were pretty sure they had passed. Well, sure enough, the next morning we found the lion's spoor between the big tree and us. That took care of some of the disappointment Harold and Bill had felt about not having their own camp." So the boys learned to respect their elders' bush knowledge. On the return route through the southern part of Barotseland, the Shorts stopped at the village of Will Short's old friend and companion evangelist, Kambole Matapamatenga. Kambole had worked with Will extensively over 30 years earlier at Sinde Mission, and on one occasion when Will had an extreme attack of malaria, carried one end of his stretcher almost 20 miles to a hospital. See Chapter 1 about that. Kambole gave Bill and Harold bows and arrows that he had made. They became treasured possessions in the Short family as mementos of their relationship with the pioneer African evangelist. The Shorts spent one of the last nights in Barotseland in a double-story house at a forestry station. During the night, Margaret heard footsteps on the stairs. She opened the door and looked out, and no one was there. The next morning, when they were leaving and thanking the forestry officials for their hospitality, one of them said, "We didn't want to worry you last night, but thought you would be interested to know that this house is supposed to be haunted." An interesting sequel to the story of the haunted house occurred 22 years later in 1980 when Foy and Margaret attended a convention of the Rotary Club in South Africa. There, they stayed in the home of Bernard and Bridget de Sosa, a high official in the South African Forestry Department. De Sosa told them that after graduating from the University of Cape Town, he had worked in Barotseland. The Shorts then told him of their trip to Barotseland, and they realized that they spent the night in the same house he had lived in. When he realized this, he asked them, "Did they tell you it was haunted? We often heard footsteps on the stairs." The trip to Barotseland made an indelible impression on the Short family, not only because of the adventures, but also because of the time spent together as three generations of a godly family seeking to spread God's message in areas where it had scarcely been heard. Trips to Namwianga Mission. Foy's parents, W.N. and Delia, worked at the Namuyanga mission in Zambia until 1961, when they moved to Bulawayo. Therefore, during the 1950s until 1961, the family traveled at least once a year to the mission for visits with the children's grandparents, other family members, and Christians there. One year, the families from the mission made a special trip to nearby Victoria Falls for the Christmas holidays. One August, Foy's brother Bill was in Guelo. The Shorts decided to take him and a friend of Harold's with them to Namuyanga. The trip would be almost 400 miles over rough roads. The only family vehicle at the time was a Volkswagen Beetle, and yet Foy decided that with some improvisation, all eight travelers could fit it with their clothes and Bill's camping gear. Ellen recalled, "The three guys, Harold, Bill, and Harold's friend, got in the back seat. Either Jim or I got into the little space behind the back seat. The other one would either sit on the guy's laps or in the space between the two front seats where the handbrake was located. Kay was a baby, so she sat on Mom's lap." She added, "We had to go through Bulawayo, and I remember Sarah Bankston coming out and saying, 'Wow,' when seeing how loaded it was." When thinking of the crowded trip to Namuyanga, Margaret remembered an occasion when Foy carried 13 young people to camp in the Volkswagen. Of course, there were no traffic laws at that time that limited the number of passengers, so trips in the overloaded Volkswagen were perfectly legal. Family trips to Namuyanga Mission were magical for little Ellen. She remembered getting up in the morning for Bible readings and prayer before breakfast, and then being allowed to play in her grandfather's print shop with all of its little cubbyholes where different type was kept. She helped her grandmother bake cookies and usually ate more dough during the preparation than cookies. Another memory was of sitting in the grove of mango trees with her cousins eating mangoes until they were about to pop. What stood out most in her mind, however, was sitting around at night with her grandparents, aunt, uncle, and cousins, reading the Bible and singing, with the only light coming from the little flickering paraffin lamps. Then, Ellen said, we were allowed to take the paraffin lights up to our bedrooms. There, the children talked and giggled until they finally fell asleep. Trip to the USA, 1961 and 1962. Foy, Margaret, and the children made a four-month trip to the States in December of 1961. The plane trip made a big impression on Jim Short, who was 10 years old at the time. The family left Salisbury on a BOAC Comet 4 jetliner to London via Nairobi, Khartoum, and Rome. After a day's layover in London, the family took a long flight on a turboprop across the Atlantic to New York City. After landing at Idlewild Airport in New York, that's now JFK Airport, the airline put them on a helicopter that flew over Manhattan to Newark Airport, where they took a flight to Huntsville. Jim said, it was about 7 o'clock in the morning flying over Manhattan. It was quite a thrill for a 10-year-old from the boondocks of Zimbabwe. When the family arrived in Huntsville, they went to a house that Margaret's family had rented in Huntsville next to Margaret's sister Kay's house. Jim said, that was our base of operation. Foy spent much of the 4 months in the Athens area and visiting congregations to speak to them about the work in Africa. He traveled over 18,000 miles through a number of states in 17 weeks. Jim said, when he added up all the talks, he averaged giving a talk for each day of the trip. A highlight of the trip was a family reunion in Athens, Alabama, at the Benny Lee Fudge House on the corner of Washington and Chandler Streets. Benny Lee Fudge realized that since Foy and his family were in the States, Almost the entire Short clan was in the country and could be brought together for the first time under one roof. Bill Short was born only after Foy, Sybil, and Beth left home to study at Abilene, so the family had never been together. The only missing pieces to a possible family reunion were Foy's parents, W.N. and Delia, who had not visited the state since 1947. Sybil said that Benny Lee raised money and bought them an airplane ticket to come over. Jim remembered that the families all piled into the Fudge's house and that everyone got 3 or 4 hours of sleep at night. Sybil said, "We had children all over the floor. There were 31 people in the house, including a young Filipino student who was living with the Fudges." Sybil added, "The women spent time in the kitchen fixing the meals and tending to the little kids. The men were off in the other room talking their heads off. We got together and sang a lot." Ellen remembered a poignant talk that her uncle Bill Short gave at the end of the reunion to all the Shorts, Fudges, Ewings, and Mansours about the spiritual heritage that had been handed to them by their parents and the need to thank God for it and to serve Him all the more diligently because of it. Then the family sang, "Blessed be the tie that binds," said their farewells, and departed back to their own places. To paraphrase Gardner S. Hall Sr., families that give themselves to the Lord's service must often be separated in this world so that they can be together in the next. At the end of their 4-month stay in the States, the Shorts flew from Huntsville to Atlanta and then to Idlewild Airport. After flying to London, their return flight skipped Rome, flying directly to Khartoum, then Nairobi, finally to Salisbury, where they took a Central African Airlines flight to Bulawayo. On the trip, Foy and Margaret bought a little cap gun for Jim at Heathrow Airport in London that looked like a 38 caliber pistol. When they arrived in Khartoum, Ellen and Jim got permission to get off the plane while it was being refueled. Jim said, "My parents were happy for us to burn off some energy." Since little Kay was asleep, Foy and Margaret decided that they would stay on board the plane. Jim left his cap pistol on the seat with his black jacket over it. When the cleaning people came through the cabin, one of them picked up Jim's little jacket and saw the cap pistol. Foy and Margaret were watching from the other side of the plane and said that the cleaning man's eyes got huge when he saw the gun. He gently put the jacket back over the pistol and ran to get a supervisor, who came and then called an immigration official, who carefully picked the gun up, saw what it was, and started laughing. Jim said, "It was almost an international incident." Though airline security wasn't nearly as tight in the early 1960s as it became 40 years later, the sight of the toy gun still caused a commotion. Holidays and meetings in South Africa. When Rhodesia was first settled by Europeans, the government advised them to go to the coast once a year for health reasons, since Rhodesia was considered to be in the tropics. Though the climate turned out to be healthier than the early authorities expected it to be, Foy and Margaret found out when arriving in the country that many white Rhodesians still had the habit of going to South Africa or Mozambique for the holiday. Foy decided that his family needed a break and built a caravan, a camper trailer, from scratch that could be hauled behind the family's car, a Vauxhall Victor. The caravan made the trip more economical. It also made it easier to afford shorter breaks to visit game parks and other points of interest within the country. Margaret, who was an excellent seamstress, sewed the cushions and curtains for the caravan and also made a tent that was attached to its side. Catherine said of the caravan and its furnishing, "People said it didn't look homemade." The family set out in December of 1964 for their holiday in a caravan park at Doonside, just south of Durban, South Africa. Jim said, It was the first family vacation that I could remember. Margaret said, quote, "Caravanning was a big thing in southern Africa, and almost every town would have a caravan club and park. I was secretary of the Gwelo branch of the Rhodesian Caravan Club for some years. We met some very interesting people at the various parks. During the year, there would be meetings at various towns. Both the Rhodesian and South African clubs printed small magazines monthly, and the various dates and venues would be printed in those. Everyone was surprised that Foy had built ours, as it didn't look homemade." Close quote. The joys of the vacation in South Africa and the fellowship with the Totes, the Votaws, and the Clerks was tempered by the shunning the Shorts received from old friends in South Africa who were pushing institutionalism, including some who had lived for months with them in 1949 in Bulawayo. Foy thought that friendship should not be severed by the controversy over institutionalism, but instead that there should be a gentlemanly exchange of ideas that would eventually bring like-minded followers of Christ to a better understanding of God's will. Though there were a few frustrating exchanges about the issue in Rhodesia, most of those who disagreed about it, at least in the southern part of the country, maintained cordial relationships with those of the other persuasion. Such would not be the case, however, in South Africa, where conservatives like Jean Tope, Ray Votaw, and Andy de Klerk were rapidly shunned by the promoters who told their followers to have nothing to do with the antis. When Foy and his family came to visit South Africa in December of 1964, they realized that the spiritual quarantine had been extended to them. Foy's old friends, who had stayed in his home in Bulawayo, refused to shake his hand because he couldn't conscientiously go along with the church-supported machinery they were promoting. This breach of etiquette was very disturbing to gentlemanly Foy, whose shock about some of the unpleasant confrontations was still evident when he talked about it over 40 years later. The emphasis on courtesy and gentility in Foy's upbringing, both at home and at his English boarding school, probably made him a bit naive about the rough and tumble approach to controversy that characterized many of his American friends. To be fair, Foy would have been just as shocked by similarly aggressive styles of some in the United States who agreed with him that institutionalism was wrong. Jim recalled that as a young teen, it was strange to observe coolness between those who had formerly been close friends. It was clear to the kids that there were issues in the relationship that hadn't been there previously. In spite of the difficulties, Jim said that his parents didn't allow the rejection of their old friends to ruin their vacation. It probably wasn't a complete surprise to them, since they had heard that the Topes and Votaws had already been ostracized because of their convictions, and they themselves had already lost some support from American churches because of the issue. The Shorts enjoyed their holiday so much in 1964 that they returned to South Africa in 1965 for a more adventuresome jaunt. Foy went down early in his Volkswagen Beetle to preach in Krugersdorf with the Topes, Springs, where Votaws lived, and Port Elizabeth, where Andy de Klerk worked. When Foy was in Springs, someone got sick while he was preaching. Ray Votaw then began to tell others that Foy had them throwing up in the aisles. By the time Foy's meetings were over, school was out in Rhodesia, and the family drove the Vauxhall and the caravan down to meet him for another holiday. Jim said, "We met up with him in Port Elizabeth, where he was finishing his meeting. Then we traveled down the garden route south of Port Elizabeth. However, they began to have problems with the car's gearbox, transmission. Foy took it to a garage in Port Elizabeth where mechanics were supposed to have fixed it. However, after driving further towards Cape Town, the gearbox seized up completely. They had to have the car towed to the nearest town, called George, where it was found that the mechanics in Port Elizabeth had forgotten to put a retaining bolt in place. Margaret said, "George was a beautiful little place a few miles from the sea with mountains behind it. With the Beetle, we were able to drive around the area while the Vauxhall was being worked on and met some nice folks. Caravanners were always very friendly." She added, "We then stayed a few days at a lovely place called Wilderness, where we had great fun playing in the sea. In 1984, two grandsons, Jody Bays and Elliot Short, visited Foy and Margaret. When they drove Elliot back to Cape Town with Jody, they stopped again at Wilderness, allowing their grandsons to frolic in the ocean in the same place their parents had played 19 years before. Foy returned to Port Elizabeth to try to get the company that had neglected to put the retaining bolt in to pay at least for part of the repairs. They tried to excuse themselves, but at least paid for half the cost of rebuilding the gearbox. Harold traveled further west to Hermanus in the Volkswagen, where his girlfriend's family were holidaying in the cottage, but the rest of the family decided to return to Rhodesia. There were no more family vacations to South Africa until 1968, when Kay and Jim accompanied their parents to Port St. John's, which is just below the south coast of Natal. By this time, Harold and Ellen had already left home. The Shorts traveled with the Nievold family, who had three sons. The oldest was a close friend of Jim's, and the youngest was Kay's age. Mr. Nievold was Jim's rugby coach. Margaret said, "Port St. John's was a fascinating place on the wild coast." She vividly remembered climbing one steep cliff with Foy. Quote, "It didn't look too bad, and we had loved climbing quite steep sides of some bare granite hills in the Matobo. Well, it turned out to be steeper than it looked, and that climb was the most frightening experience of my life. Thus, my memory of cliffs. The Nievolts were waiting in the car at the top, and I think they were just about as relieved as we were when we got there." Foy continued to hold meetings in South Africa through the years, and especially enjoyed the time he spent with Ray Votaw, Gene Tope, and Paul Williams. He reported in 1973 that a trip there had been a real boost. These close friends from South Africa also visited congregations where Foy worked in Rhodesia in the 1960s and 1970s. Ray Votaw remembered that when visiting Foy, quote, "He forgot the keys to his house about five times. We had to break into his house," close quote. He said that he recommended on occasions that Foy be given the topic, "Forgetting those things which are behind," because he was so good at forgetting. On another occasion, Foy wanted Votaw to ride a horse that he had just bought, stating in effect that since Votaw was from Texas, he should know something about horses. However, Votaw said, "He must have put a burr under the saddle, because as soon as I got on the horse, he threw me off." Votaw said that Foy thought it was funny, but he didn't at the time. Intensive training of young preachers. While in Guelo, Foy decided to spend a large portion of his time teaching young preachers in a regimented training program. His first students were his protege from Bulawayo, Paddy Kendallball, Melville Sheesby, and Foy's right-hand man, Enoch Newby. Kendallball recalled, "We studied Greek, Hebrew, Old Testament, New Testament, denominational doctrines, and speaking." The young men were expected to be in class from 8 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon each day, and then afterwards study and fulfill their other obligations. Paddy Kendallball laughed when recalling the class on public speaking. "Each participant in the class had to make a talk and then be critiqued, including Foy." Patty said that he and the other students decided to really nail Foy for what they called his monotone. They told him, "It's dry, it's not interesting." Foy seemed to take their suggestions to heart, and Kendall Ball said, "I would like to think that we taught Foy to preach properly." He acknowledged, however, that Foy gave as good as he got when it came time to critique others. It was impossible to continue at the first semester's pace. Kendall Ball said that besides the 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. class schedule, he and the others also had to teach a daily class at the local schools, study for their lessons, and work with the church at Guelo and with the African Brethren in rural areas. Therefore, the second semester, they only met for classes once a week, but with more homework. Melville Cheesby studied that way for 2 years. Patty studied for 3.5 years with Foy. Several others, including Richard Lang, also studied with Foy during his early years at Guelo. Foy continued special study sessions with young men throughout his years in Guelo, although on a smaller scale. He reported in May of 1973 that he had special classes with 7 African preachers and praised their down-to-earth approach to the scriptures when compared to the tendency of some Americans to seek loopholes. Instrumental music, institutionalism. One of Foy's students in his intensive training in Guelo was Wendell Freeman, the preacher at the local Christian church. Foy and the others received him into the program with open arms. Foy invited him to write an article defending instrumental music in an English paper called The Inquirer that Foy published to provide a forum for giving both sides of controversial issues such as institutionalism. Foy always clearly stated his convictions, but felt it important to be loving and respectful in doing so, while giving those of the other side opportunities to present their cases. After discussing the fact that God entrusted the gospel to man, he said in the first issue of the Inquirer, quote, "It is not the prerogative of any man or group of men to seek to build a wall around truth or followers of truth to cut them off from contact with error. Rather, it is man's responsibility to proclaim truth as widely and vigorously as possible, following the divine example of leaving it to the hearer to discern what is right and wrong. Jesus taught in this way, placing truth clearly, openly, alongside error, that the deceptions of error might be exposed by truth. It is our purpose in publishing this magazine, The Inquirer, to provide an open forum for the investigation of Bible subjects, both controversial and non-controversial." Close quote. Foy added, "Articles which in the editor's judgment contain sarcastic or disparaging expressions, if printed at all, will be edited to remove the objectionable features." He later promised, "We will endeavor to be completely impartial in our allocation of space." However, Foy wasn't able to convince his brethren and even close family members to participate in exchanges about institutionalism in The Inquirer. His father, William Newton, who he greatly loved, was sympathetic with the promoters of institutionalism, as was his brother-in-law, Henry Ewing, with whom he had worked so closely and so effectively at Queen's Park in Bulawayo in the 1950s. Ewing, in explaining his desire not to participate in exchanges, told Foy, "It would be fine to have a paper if we all agreed." Foy said, "We just had to use printed articles for the liberal viewpoint, as there was no interest among the more liberal brethren to participate." In 1962, brethren in Bulawayo asked Foy to come and speak at the dedication service of the new building at the New Hillside Congregation. However, fearing that he might mention institutionalism, they put in a few restrictions about what he could say. Foy wrote back and said that he just taught the scriptures, but that he wasn't going to preach anywhere where there were restrictions on what he would preach. The restrictions were lifted, and Foy was able to conscientiously preach in the new building. For many years, Foy sent his father copies of the Inquirer to distribute among the brethren at Hillside, where he was an elder. Later, he found out that his father put the papers on the top shelf of the library and never distributed them to anyone. The Hillside Church in Bulawayo, therefore, went for years without allowing any teaching one way or the other on the topic of institutionalism. The Queen's Park congregation in Bulawayo taught against institutionalism, while the Bellevue congregation, started in the 1970s by J.C. Shoemaker, actively sympathized with it. One day in the early 1960s, Foy was having a lively discussion about institutionalism with his mother at the house in Guelo. Both enjoyed the give and the take, little noticing how uncomfortable Foy's father was with what was going on. Suddenly, Foy's father said that it was time to leave, got up and took Delia out the door to the car, and they drove away without any goodbyes. The abruptness of the departure shook up Foy and his family. Ellen recalls that her mother was crying. After driving away, Delia began to talk to her husband to convince him to return to the house and explain why the discussion had upset him so much. A few minutes later, they returned to the house in a much calmer frame of mind, and Foy's father gave them an explanation of his actions. He told them that as a child, he had heard family members constantly bickering over issues like instrumental music, Bible classes, and the number of containers to be used in the Lord's Supper, to the point that he was very much averse to that type of discussion. They upset him so much that he could not tolerate them. Jim Short recalled that his father had a brother who did not believe in Bible classes in the church, nor the use of multiple containers in the Lord's Supper. Though this brother was quite prosperous during the Depression, he sent no financial help to W.N. Short, who was struggling to survive on remote outposts in southern Africa. His brother considered him a false teacher. W.N. Short was also affected by the fierce attacks against his mentor, J.N. Armstrong, by Foy Wallace and others for not being aggressive enough in fighting premillennialism. Short felt that such attacks were totally unchristian and destructive. This combination of factors led the pioneer evangelist to avoid sharp disagreements with his brethren, though he did have exchanges with those of mainstream denominations. The controversy about institutionalism was never as acrimonious in the southern part of Rhodesia as it was in South Africa and parts of the United States. Though firm in his convictions, Foy maintained friendly relations with most of his brethren who disagreed with him about it. However, in Salisbury in the north, Americans from the Norway mission were more militant in marking those who opposed their teaching. They were able to take over the congregation in Salisbury in the early 1960s and made unflattering remarks about Foy to his son Harold, Alan Hadfield, and others. Alan Hadfield returned to Bulawayo to help start the congregation in Hillside. After the Americans left Salisbury, conservative brethren there started a new congregation in 1971 and invited Foy to come and preach for them whenever possible. Jim Short worked with this group from 1975 through 1981. Opportunities in English in neighboring cities. The Shorts had opportunity to teach the Bible in English in neighboring towns. Doug Bauer was from a family converted by Foy's father, W.N. Short, in Macheke. And speaking of Bauer, Margaret said, "One of his young brothers was living in Kwekwe, about 40 miles from us. We went up once a week to study. They were baptized. Eventually, Doug came and worked in Kwekwe." She added, "One family that we baptized in Guelo and one that we'd baptized in Bulawayo had moved to Mazvingo, formerly Fort Victoria. They met in each other's homes. We went down there fairly often to help." There were close ties between the brethren in Guelo and those in Kwekwe. In 1972, Foy wrote in his bulletin, We had 23 visitors from Kwekwe congregation on Sunday night. What a boost it gave us to enjoy their fellowship during the evening service. He wrote an encouraging report in 1972 about a meeting Paul Williams held in Kwekwe and Gwelo, where there was one baptism. He said, "Brother Williams did the church much good, leaving us lessons that were sorely needed." 4 days after the meeting, there was a second baptism. Periodical in the Shona and the Sindabele languages. As in Bulawayo, Foy and his companions would find many opportunities to teach those of the Amandabele tribe in Gwelo. Since they were in the Midlands region, which also had a border with Mashonaland, they would also have opportunities with the Shonas. Jim remembers that Sunday mornings were always dedicated to the English-speaking work, and then Foy would go in the afternoons out into the countryside and preach for brethren of African descent. Often, he took Jim and other members of his family with him. To supplement his work, Foy began to publish a monthly teaching paper in 1962 titled Inkiniso and Swakadi, which means truth, in the Sindabele and Shona languages. At first, he used a mimeograph machine to print up the papers, but eventually was able to buy a big Kodak camera to make plates and use an offset press. At first, he printed almost 2,000 copies of the paper in each language, using articles that dealt primarily with the first principles of the Bible. Later, his circulation count approached 10,000. He dedicated much space in his papers to analyzing the false teachings of the religious sects and denominations. Foy wrote in 1962, quote, "One way we are trying to teach the native Christians more is through the printing and distribution of literature. The Market Street congregation in Athens, Alabama, is supplying us with the funds needed to buy supplies for this and to hire a native man to translate material. Brother Enoch Newbing is working with us in this, and we're teaching him to type. Until he learns to type, Margaret and I are having to double up on our work and do the typing of stencils in the Sindabele language. During May and June, we have printed a total of about 3,500 items, and this will be increased as Brother Knube can take over some of the typing." Close quote. Foy mailed the paper to individuals and congregations. He said, "It was amazing how those things spread. I got letters from 200 to 300 miles away from people who got them and wanted information about them. A number of congregations were started from them. Even today, when I go to a few congregations, people will bring out an old tattered paper and say, 'These are the papers that got us started here.'" The paper became especially important during the Bush War that started in the late 1960s, when it became more dangerous for Foy and others to go into the countryside to teach. Foy continued to publish the paper until 1984, by which time the Bush War had ended and post-election political violence was beginning to wane. At that time, he had so many appointments with churches that he didn't feel he had the time to continue the printing. With any publication, there is usually the frustrating need to fight with bulky machines. Though such aggravations didn't make it into official reports, they made it into private letters. Foy wrote Ellen in 1968, "I've had a lot of trouble with the printing press, mainly because I am, or was, so inexperienced in the use of it. For about 3 months, I could hardly get anything printed. But now, I've mastered the art of adjusting it, and things are going smoothly. Only I've been trying to catch up on 3 months of printing. On Friday, the 21st, I finished the May papers. Tomorrow, I plan to get started on June's paper. If I can get that done in the next 7 to 10 days, then I'll be ready to start on the July paper before July is more than half gone." Progress among African churches. Paddy Kendallball says that five names stand out in his mind when thinking of effective African workers among the Amandabele in the 1960s. Jeffrey Nyembezi, Teli Moyo, Major Mpofu, Enoch Nubi, and David Nlovu. Newman Gumbo became prominent in the work later. Kendall said that they just worked and worked and taught and taught. All remained faithful to the Lord into the 1970s and 1980s, except for Major Mpofu. When seeing Kendall's list, Foy and Margaret insisted on adding another preacher, Nesu Moyo, to the list of outstanding preachers, stating, "He was one of our favorites." Foy's reports in the 1970s also mention the work of James Machaya, a preacher he taught out of a Pentecostal denomination. Of these effective evangelists, Kendall was especially close to Enoch Nubi, who he says was like a father to him. Kendall said in 2008, "He's the only one that's still living. He's 78 and still going strong. He's very knowledgeable about the scriptures and a great teacher. He's fantastic." Ellen Bay said of Nubi, "I don't know of any person in this world that I respect more than that man." Kendall talked about the growth of churches he knew in the rural areas around Gweru and their numbers in the early 2000s. He mentioned Cinderella, 19.5 kilometers southeast of Gweru, with about 25 or 30 members. Another congregation in the Goko Plains area, an area heavily populated by Seventh-day Adventists, had only 7 members for many years until Newman Gumbo and other evangelists began giving special attention to the area, sitting up all hours of the night teaching contacts. There were 2 congregations on the other side of Gweru, the north, with over 100 members apiece. Once, Patty and his wife Sandy gave a ride to a woman from Goko Plains area to Gwelo who was a Seventh-day Adventist. Sandy encouraged her to attend services with them, but the woman was very reluctant. However, she said something that encouraged the Kendalls. "You have captured many of our people." Patty thought, "Yes," and then good-naturedly asked the woman, "Can we capture you?" However, she replied, "No." Foy was constantly amazed at the ability of some of the African evangelists to explain biblical principles in simple terms to the people. Once, when a Lutheran preacher asked about predestination, Teli Moyo responded that farmers should understand the principle well. He said, "God predestined, made a law, that every seed would bring forth after its kind. If you want to raise mealies, you must plant mealies. If you want to raise peanuts, you must plant peanuts. That's God's law for the field." Brother Moyo then pointed out that God's spiritual law of predestination is similar to this. Paul teaches us in Galatians 6 that as a man sows, so shall he reap. If we plant righteousness, we will reap eternal life. This is God's law for the Spirit. In both cases, God predestined, made these laws for sowing and reaping. Foy said of the illustration, "I've never heard predestination explained more simply nor accurately." Ellen Bay said, "Big Boy Dube tells me on nearly every trip how Dad confronted problems. He went directly to the source and asked questions. On one occasion, a group of brethren were together, and Foy asked one to repeat an accusation he had made against another. Since it was false, the man declined, and the issue was laid to rest. On another occasion, a preacher was very upset because another preacher had put a curse on him." Ellen said, "Dad talked with a man who had been cursed and asked him who was the greatest spirit, God or this spirit who was supposed to curse him." Foy summed up his feelings about work among African brethren in 1962. He said, It is a never-failing thrill to see the eagerness with which the African people respond to the gospel. They see so much in it that they instinctively feel that they need. But it's sad to see how discouraged they can get, too. What we must endeavor to do is to provide them with more teaching, not merely on becoming a Christian, but that infinitely more difficult and longer process of living the Christian life. African customs and food. In an outline titled Preaching the Gospel in Zimbabwe that Foy elaborated in 1999, he pointed out cultural traditions in southern Africa that sometimes puzzled Westerners. Innate courtesy. Request permission to enter district, village, house, church assembly. Respect of younger for the elderly. Western influence causing this to change. Women kneel or curtsy when serving men. Women sit on the floor giving chairs to men. All, when offering a gift with the right hand, place left hand on the right hand wrist. Why? Some say it is so that it may be seen that nothing is in the left hand and that no weapon is concealed in the left hand. Non-confrontational attitude. Disregard for cues, that is, waiting lines. No thought for an individual space. They crowd upon each other in gatherings. When passing your house at night, they will talk and sing loudly. This is to let you know that they are passing. Only those with criminal intent will sneak past quietly. The place and role of women. Much of the work is done by women. American preachers can effectively preach on the husband-wife relationship. And Foy mentioned observing a preacher allow his friend's wife to carry his bag, suitcase, as well as her own two big bundles. Foy concluded the outline by pointing out that differences not contrary to the Bible must be left alone, while cultural differences violating scriptural principles must be dealt with. Preachers from Zimbabwe were more capable of dealing with these problems, and therefore their training was of supreme importance. When giving a report on the work in Zimbabwe to brethren in Bel Air, near Houston, Texas, Foy described other African customs in more detail. Quote, "When people are talking and you come upon them, you don't avoid going between them. Going around them would indicate some kind of underhanded scheme that you didn't want to face them or that you wanted to sneak around them. They'll walk right between conversing people, whereas you and I wouldn't dream of it. Many walk 15 miles, bring food and cook it. It's served to the men first by women who curtsy or get on their knees to hand the food to the men. An American woman and her husband were there to preach. She saw this and thought it wasn't maintaining the dignity women should have. So she began talking to the women and telling them that they shouldn't do this. After a little while, the women came to her and said, 'We would like to ask you not to teach about this matter of kneeling anymore. It is our custom. It is our way of showing our love and respect for our husbands.' Foy then said, to her credit, she listened to their advice. There are some Americans that are too hard-headed to listen to anything like that. Another American woman told Zimbabwean women in Kensington, a congregation in Bulawayo started by Newman Gumbo, that they only had to wear the covering when worshiping because of their custom, not because the Bible taught it. Lillian Gumbo spoke up and told her that Margaret Short had taught them about this from the Bible. To the woman's credit, she dropped the subject and never brought it up again. Foy gave an explanation to the brethren in Bel Air about mealy meal, the primary food in Zimbabwe. He said, "Cornmeal is the main food, cooked mushy with gravy or a stew or stewed vegetable to help the mush go down. It's cooked very thick and served on a plate. You take a handful of it, roll it up in your hands, and then dip it into the gravy or put some of their relish with it. That's their way of eating. That's their staple diet. Foy described the traditional way of building their huts, where small groups would sometimes crowd for service, especially during his younger days. Quote, "They put poles in the ground and then plaster them over with mud. Sometimes they'll have a little window for air to flow through, but many times they won't. They'll have a wood fire in the center of the hut where there's no chimney. The smoke gets real heavy in there. There have been times when I've had to sit in one of those huts while an African preacher preached for an hour or two, and my eyes started streaming. It was hard to breathe. They seem to get along with it all right." Foy discussed the fact that funerals were always a challenge for Christians because of superstitions that surrounded them. Quote, "The belief is that after death, the spirit wanders about for a year, looking for a place to live. At the close of that year, the family has a feast and beats the grave, indicating that this is the place the departed spirit should live. The feast not only involves drinking the ceremonial beer, but eating that which is devoted to the memory of the spirit. The accession of the elder son as head of his late father's family in particular hinges on this. This entails a major part of the family property. An eldest son who refuses to participate in the ceremony cannot be his father's heir. Other children who refuse to participate lose their standing in the family circle and will usually be blamed for any tragedy or distress that comes upon the family." Close quote. Jim Short recalled some events in his life that illustrated interesting aspects of African culture. One illustrated the African sense of humor. Quote, "They will laugh at situations that we would not. When people are in trouble or embarrassed, they, including the person at the center of the situation, will simply laugh uproariously about it." I was teaching a class about eight young men who wanted to become preachers. One of them asked me what kind of body we would receive at the resurrection. I referred to 1 Corinthians 15 and said that it would be a glorified, eternal body. Well, that wasn't sufficient, and he wanted to know more. Exactly what kind of a body would that be? Again, I suggested that we don't know, but that it would be wonderful and eternal. Well, he continued to press the question. I finally just asked him to read aloud 1 Corinthians 15, 35, and 36, where Paul suggests that people may ask that question, but how foolish to do so. As he read it, he just cracked up, as did everyone else in the class. He thought it was a great answer, and we went on with the class. I don't think I could have gotten by with that in the United States, at least not with a lot of folks. Close quote. He also told a story about Newman Gumbo that illustrated the African's indirect directness. Quote, "When I was there in 1993 after my dad's heart surgery, I was driving with Newman Gumbo to one of the rural churches when he began a conversation that went along these lines. There's a lot of work to be done here in Zimbabwe. I, of course, agreed. Your father is getting older. Again, I agreed. Your father is damaging his health by trying to do all the work. I again agreed. Your father needs someone to help him. And again, I had to agree. Someone a little younger needs to come and help him. What could I do but agree? Someone your age." Without saying it, he had in fact said that I should come to Zimbabwe to work with my dad. Had there been a way for me to do that and be able to provide for my family, I would have done it. End of chapter 4, part 1.